start this morning's sutta. And this morning we're going to have a look at the Anapanasati Sutta, which is the sutta on mindfulness of breathing. And does anybody need a spare? There's a couple of spare copies up here for anyone who hasn't got one. Anyone like you? Yeah, Nathan? Okay. 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 Anyone else who hasn't got a copy? Everybody okay? I'll just wait for the retreatants first of all. Yeah, we made one. Okay, great. There you are. Yeah, I'll give you a copy later on, Nathan. Yeah. Nathan is one of our anagarikas at the monastery, so he can get one at any time. I'll get one for him later on. So the Anapanasati Sutta, this is the sutta on mindfulness of breathing. And that's quite literally what Anapanasati means in the Pali language. This is one of the foundational discourses by the Buddha on meditation practice. And this is a sutta that you find in many different places, in different settings, with different people, slightly different variations on the same theme. And this is how you know that it is an important sutta. Things that occur again and again are things that are very meaningful and obviously something the Buddha placed a lot of emphasis on. That's why it is found in so many different places. So this is really the, if you want to know what Buddhist meditation really is about, this is really what it comes down to, the idea of just watching the breath, the in and out breathing. And it's interesting, many people do, for example, metta meditation is quite a common meditation topic for people who practice the Buddhist path. And yet metta meditation is not really described in the same kind of detail as the mindfulness of breathing in the suttas. Metta is more given like, you know, you spread metta to the four directions. But it doesn't really give a lot of detail on how to do this. The reason for this, presumably, is that mindfulness of breathing is actually more basic, more essential, more important aspect of the Buddhist path. And that's why it is given in such details. One of the themes, of course, one of the very important aspects of Buddhist meditation is the Satipatthana practice. The four foundations of mindfulness, as it's sometimes called. I like to call it the four applications of mindfulness, how we use mindfulness once it gets established. Obviously, also very important, if you read anything about Buddhism, it doesn't take long before you come across the four Satipatthanas. And yet, when you read about the Satipatthanas, it is not as clear again how they are to be practiced, because the information given in the suttas is of a very general kind. It's not very specific. It says, you know, you are aware of the feelings, but it doesn't actually say the context on how you are aware of the feelings, what you do. So that this leads to a large number of interpretations. But there is one way in which one type of meditation that is explained in great detail, and that is precisely Anapanasati, mindfulness of breathing. So this really is core, this really is very fundamental to the Buddhist path. And it's one of the reasons I thought it might be very useful to have a look at this on this retreat, because it is so important. Let's just start. I will start reading out what it has to say here, and then I will comment on this as we go along. This is usually the way I like to do the sutta readings. Just read a little bit and then comment on it as I go along. And if anything is unclear, something is always unclear. It's impossible to be 100% clear, unfortunately. So please ask questions later on this evening. Write something down, and I'll be very happy to try to clarify things later on. When mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated, it is of great fruit and great benefit. When mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated, it fulfills the four applications of mindfulness. When the four applications of mindfulness are developed and cultivated, they fulfill the seven awakening factors. When the seven awakening factors are developed and cultivated, they fulfill true knowledge and deliverance, or liberation, or freedom, if you like, on the last one there. So this is obviously already a very important statement right there at the beginning here. Yeah, this is the way the Buddha often sets up his discourses. He sets up by telling you how useful it is, or how important it is, and how powerful it is. And that kind of gives you the motivation to listen. Yeah, wow, well, it leads to true knowledge and deliverance. Well, I'll explain in a minute what that means. But it basically leads all the way to the end of the Buddhist path. And all we have to do is to watch the breath. It's good news, right? All you have to do is watch the breath, and it goes all the way from the beginning, from the little happiness that you get by just becoming peaceful, from the joy you get in the meditation, to the insights, all the way to the very end, to the awakening itself, which is the culmination and the purpose of the Buddhist path. All you have to do is watch the breath. Isn't that a wonderful thing already? It's kind of a very uplifting message. It's so simple. Sometimes we think that the spiritual life is very difficult. Sometimes you read about dependent origination, insight into non-self. You read about contemplating things in the right way. And it sounds so, sometimes you wonder how you're ever going to be able to do all of these things. It sounds so profound and difficult and hard and kind of, you know, what's really going on here. But actually, it is very, very simple. And it's one of those important points to understand. When you read the suttas, it may seem like it is very complicated. That's just because expressing ideas that are profound is often makes it sound complicated. But when you actually experience them for yourself, it's actually very simple. And that's why watching the breath is all you have to do. And through the watching of the breath, all the peace, all the insight, all the metta even in the world that is possible to experience arises through that practice. That is all we have to do. Yeah, so this is already, it's a very powerful little statement by the Buddha in the beginning there. And it kind of motivates you very, very powerfully to do the simple meditation practices that he recommends. So the first thing he says there is that it is of great fruit and benefit. Well, okay, yeah. It fulfills the four applications of mindfulness. I just mentioned the applications of mindfulness a second ago. And the applications of mindfulness is the application of mindfulness to the body. And often in the Satipatthana Sutta, which is the main sutta on the practice of the applications of mindfulness, it talks about, looking at the body in terms of its 31 parts, looking at the body in terms of the elements, yeah? Solidity, water element, air element, and also the heat element in the body. And then realizing that the body is no different from the external elements. It's just a way of giving rise to a bit of not so much attachment to the body. When you realize the body here is the same as external elements, it kind of makes the body less significant in a sense. So that is all very well and nice. But what the Buddha is saying here is that actually you don't really have to do those things. They can be supportive, but it actually is enough just to watch the breath. By watching the breath, by following the breath in the right way, you have to do it in the right way. Yeah? This is what we're going to talk about in a second. Doing it in the right way, all of that is fulfilled. The entire body contemplation is done just by watching the breath. Then the Satipatthana Sutta goes on to contemplating feelings. Yeah, feelings is the pleasure in an experience, or the displeasure in an experience, or the neutrality. And it just says that you contemplate these feelings in various ways. It doesn't say how you do it. But here it says, all you have to do is watch the breath. As you watch the breath in the right way, various types of feelings will arise. Yeah, and because the feelings arise at that point, you are actually contemplating those feelings. That's all you have to do. It becomes so simple. Things that may seem so abstruse and uncertain and profound actually becomes very simple once you just bring it back to the breath meditation. And so it is all the way through the four Satipatthanas. This is what it comes back down to. I think that the Buddha, when he talks about Satipatthana practice, the main thing that he is talking about is actually breath meditation itself. And that is why he says this, right here, that you fulfill the Satipatthanas through breath meditation. That's really all you have to do. The rest is more unclear and more uncertain. Here is very specific, very particular, and very clear what you have to do. And this is why the Buddha phrased it in this way. And then, by fulfilling the four foundations or the four applications of mindfulness, that fulfills the seven factors of awakening. Yeah, what are the seven factors of awakening? It's all about samadhi. It's all about the joy and the happiness on the path, eventually reaching to samadhi. That's what these are about. And again, all you have to do that, is to watch the breath. All the samadhi in the world comes from watching the breath, if you do it in the right way. And eventually, if you have samadhi, it leads to true knowledge and deliverance. True knowledge in Buddhism just means insight according to reality, especially seeing your own mind, understanding your own mind, what it actually is. And then, because of true knowledge, you have deliverance, it says here, freedom, liberation. It means liberation, primarily it means liberation from problems, liberation from suffering. And of course, the flip side of that coin is happiness. If you don't have any more suffering in life, it means all you have left is happiness, peace, contentment, metta, compassion. All of the positive things come in its place. It kind of makes sense, to be able to be happy here. You have to see things according to reality here. When you see things in the right way, when you see things according to reality, it means that you can act on the basis of the way the world actually is. If you are acting on delusion, if you're acting on confusion, not on the way the world actually is, you're going to make mistakes because you're coming from the wrong place. So it's one of the basic things of to be able to find happiness at any time, at any place, is to actually act on reality, to see things according to truth. It's quite obvious when you think about it. And that's why knowledge and happiness always goes together. When you know, you can't be happy. If you are deluded, there's no way you're going to be happy because you're going to go in the wrong direction all the time. It's so obvious when you think about that. Knowledge and happiness always have to come together. By knowledge here, we mean true insight into reality. So this is what a mindfulness of breathing is promising. Pretty good, right? It's pretty good, So it's really kind of, once you kind of get the feel, this is what I mean by right outlook. I was talking yesterday about this idea of ujjukha ditti, right outlook, Looking at the world according to the suttas. And it really makes you, when you see these things, it makes you kind of excited. Wow, this is what this path is promising here. And many of you would know these things already because you've been reading the suttas for a long time, but it's always nice to repeat these things and reinforce some of these wonderful things that are there. So now let's find out how this is done. So now the promise has been made. So what do we actually have to do? And how bhikkhus? Bhikkhus, by the way, means monks. So someone like this, some of these ones. How bhikkhus is mindfulness of breathing developed and cultivated? But I should also add that when it says bhikkhus like that, it also implies bhikkhunis, the nuns as well. It also implies the lay people, so you're not excluded because it just says bhikkhus. Everybody is really implied in this. It is the way the idiom of this of the ancient Pali language is that you speak to what is like the main group of people who are present. So because the bhikkhus would have been the main group usually, because they were closest to the Buddha, they would sit next to him, there would have been most of those because they would have been around him all the time. He tends to address everything to the bhikkhus. It does not mean that it doesn't apply to everyone. How bhikkhus is mindfulness of breathing developed and cultivated so that it is of great fruit and great benefit? Here, a bhikkhu gone to the forest or to the root of a tree or to an empty hut sits down, having folded his legs crosswise, set his body erect, and established mindfulness in front of him. Ever mindful, he breathes in. Ever mindful, he breathes out. So that is the kind of the background. This is the basis on which mindfulness of breathing is cultivated. And as very often is the case, some of these introductory statements are some of the most important ones, because this is what gives you the possibility of doing mindfulness of breathing. Get the introduction right, get the kind of the foundation right, and everything else tends to happen as a matter of course. So I think that in many ways it can be said that this is perhaps the most important aspect of the whole mindfulness of breathing, this introductory statement. Yeah, you haven't really got to watching the breath yet. It's all about making things right. And that is the most important part here. So what does it say? So the first thing it says here, gone to the forest or the root of a tree or to an empty hut. Yeah? Now you know why you're here. Yeah? Now you know why you come here? Because this is like the forest. It's like an empty hut. This is one of the reasons why we have single rooms in this meditation center. The vast majority of meditation centers around the world would be more like dormitory accommodation, but it's actually very beneficial to have individual rooms. It means you can relax more, you can be more at ease, you have more degree of solitude, yeah? And you actually withdraw from your ordinary life. You come to serpentine, to the, you know, out into the bush, and what a wonderful thing it is to be surrounded by nature. It is so beautiful, it is so peaceful, it is so calming. Yeah? And this gives you some of the idea why this is so important. I think one of the reasons that many of you come here is that you find that when you come here, it is different from meditating at home. Yeah? Sometimes at home, because everything is around you, your family, your house, your possessions, your work, everything is kind of surrounding you all the time, it's actually difficult to withdraw mentally from that stuff because it's always around you. So much of this is the psychology. Yeah, psychology is actually a very important part. And when things are close to us, we are kind of psychologically difficult for us to withdraw from those things because they are physically close to us. And this is why in the suttas we have this idea of kaya viveka and citta viveka. Kaya, body, viveka means seclusion or withdrawal. Yeah. So from that withdrawal of the body, physical withdrawal, then the mind is able to withdraw as well. So the circumstances actually matter. It matters where we are. And you will, and please note that. Note how nice it is to withdraw sometimes from your ordinary life and go to a place that is a real retreat center. And this is why monastics, we tend to live in the forest. Yeah? Ideally, monastic life should be away from the village, away from the city, for exactly the same reason. Because you are withdrawing physically, and that makes it easier for the mind also to withdraw from all of those things. So these things are important. The idea of seclusion actually matters. And it's astonishing in the suttas how the Buddha, how much emphasis he places on this. There's one sutta that I always quote on these retreats, and for those of you who have been there before, you probably think, oh no, not that one again, but but this is one of those nice, it's a very simple little sutta, but it's a sutta where the Buddha is walking around and is seeing the monks, and he sees one monk, and this monk is sitting on the edge of the village, yeah, sitting in samadhi, right, very straight, and he's obviously getting some good meditation, yeah, and then the Buddha says about him, this is the kind of the weird thing, and this is how sometimes things are quite counterintuitive. But even though his meditation is going well, the Buddha says of him, I'm not pleased with this monk. Yeah, and then he says, why? The reason I'm not pleased with him is because soon enough, somebody will come and disturb him. He's sitting too close to the village. Then the Buddha goes into the forest, and he sees a monk in the forest. He's sitting there, he's nodding, he's dozing, right? Like some of you have just come from work, you're also dozing a little bit, which is natural. It's just the nature of the mind. Sometimes you're just tired. So seeing this monk in the forest dozing away, then he says, wow, I'm really happy with this monk. Yeah? It's counterintuitive. And what he says is that I'm happy with him because he's sitting in the right place, because he's meditating in the right place. He will overcome that tiredness. And when he overcomes the tiredness, his mind will become bright and brilliant. And he will not be disturbed by anyone. He will have the perception of forest. And that perception of forest, he will be able to sustain. So it matters. Yeah, it matters where we are as well. It is not just a matter of whether your meditation is going well or bad. The broader picture also matters in these things. So this is actually the importance the Buddha places on the idea of solitude, withdrawing from the world, allowing the mind to like dry out. That's one of the metaphors Ajahn Brahm used a long time ago, dry out of the worldly things. And the only way you can do that is to go to a place where it doesn't get kind of wetted by all the worldly stuff, if you like. Yeah. So this is an important thing, and the Buddha always says to the monks, monks, there are these empty huts, there are these roots of trees, meditate, or you will regret it later on. And then the Buddha says here, you sit down. Yeah, so breath meditation happens in the sitting posture. It's very difficult to do breath meditation while you walk. If you're going to do walking meditation, and it's very nice and useful to do walking meditation, but I would recommend you to do some other subject, yeah? Something maybe contemplate. You can contemplate the suttas a little bit, or you can, you know, do some other thing, do a bit of metta perhaps, or you can just walk back and forth, just enjoying yourself, or whatever it is. But breath meditation is best done while seated. And this shows you that it is a profound meditation, because that's why it happens in the sitting posture. Yeah, having folded your legs crosswise. So this, some people read this as an absolute. You cannot do breath meditation unless you sit on the floor with your legs crossed. I don't think it is meant quite like that. At this time in India, it was very common to sit on the ground. Yeah, people had chairs in those days too, but it wasn't as common as it is now. Now you grow up on sitting on a chair. You never really sat on the ground, and when you try to sit cross-legged, it's excruciating. It's like, oh, I can sit for 5 minutes, then I have to get up afterwards. And so this is the idea here, is not to force yourself to do things that are unnatural. I know of many people who get really good meditation by sitting on chairs. So there's no problem there. It's just that this was the natural way of doing things at this time in India, and we don't actually have to follow these things. Sitting on the ground is nice, it's a comfortable posture once you get used to it, and it's kind of steady and good, so it's certainly useful if you can, but if you can't, it's not a big deal. Then take any other posture that works for you, essentially. The most important thing here is to be comfortable and at ease. That is what matters. Yeah, so you fold across crosswise, or if you sit on a chair, you sit on a chair, or whatever else you do. You can even lie down, as I mentioned before. You set your body erect. Yeah, so it means that you are reasonably straight, whether you sit on a chair or not. And you can feel that when you sit straight. It's like there tends to be more clarity there in the mind as well. Yeah, if you slump too much, that's kind of usually what happens when you start dozing and falling asleep. Ideally, you sit straight. But remember, all of these things are at the right time. Timing here is really the critical element. So even sitting straight, if you feel really tired and you're kind of, you know, your mind is all over the place, don't force yourself to sit straight at the wrong time. Allow the straightness almost to happen by itself. Initially, if you do feel tired, you can sit leaning against the wall, for example, or sitting back against the chair and lean back. And that's perfectly okay. Or, you know, if you feel really, really tired, even if you doze or you kind of start nodding and all these kind of things, it's okay. Don't have to worry about that. But there comes a time when your mind gets clear, and that you will almost know it automatically that this is the time to sit straight. And then you sit straight. All of these instructions have to be understood in the right way. Otherwise, they just become a negative, a burden in your meditation practice. Everything at the right time. Nothing really through force. Nothing in a way which makes you feel tense or negative inside one way or another. Yeah. So the right time and place is important for these things. Yeah? And then it says, and this is kind of the last one, it's probably the most important one of all, having established mindfulness in front of you. Yeah, this is such an important thing, because one of the biggest problem with the mindfulness of breathing is that far too many people, they go to the breath too quickly. Yeah? You go to the breath before you are ready. Yeah? And if you go to the breath before you are ready, there's only one way you're going to be able to watch the breath. And that is by using force, by using willpower. You're going to grasp onto the breath. And when you do that, if you have to grasp onto the breath, what happens is that it becomes unpleasant. Yeah, you know what I mean? When sometimes you watch the breath and it doesn't really feel beautiful, it doesn't feel pleasant, you don't feel at ease, you don't feel relaxed. And the reason for that is because you're holding on too much. And the reason you're holding on too much is because you haven't got the mindfulness established yet. is if you have proper mindfulness, watching the breath is very straightforward. The breath is there, you just place your attention on it because you have mindfulness, the mind doesn't wander, it's no problem. It is when the mindfulness isn't there, that is when you have to use force. Yeah, so this getting that right is so important, to get that right. So how do we do that? How do we actually allow the mindfulness to arise? One aspect is what you do now while you are here for these 2 days. And what you have to do is just basically just allow yourself to relax, to be at ease, and just observe. Learn to sit back and allow the world, allow the mind to calm down. And as you do that, as you just observe, pure observation without any kind of involvement is the opposite of willpower. Yeah? Because you're just observing, you're allowing things to be, you're not involving yourself. And because you're not involving yourself, the will, it's like you're withdrawing the will from the equation of meditation practice. You get a simpler equation. You cross out a few of those x squared, the most complicated things, and you make it simple. It's an easy equation. And when the equation becomes easy and things become simple, that's when you know that things are going right. You just observe. Just allow things to be. And then the mind rests, because the willpower is what makes the mind tired. And the mind also starts to calm down, because the willpower is what sustains the thinking and all of these disturbances in the mind. And you start to feel at peace, you start to feel relaxed, you start to feel at ease. But again, it's tricky, because you when you want to have that awareness and just sit there and watch, it's very easy to use force again, yeah? So you have to watch yourself, because you have to be careful not that to kind of always, there's this tendency inside of us to use our willpower, our force, to get anything, because we are so used to that. And the ability to just stand back and watch and not do anything, actually that is probably one of the most important trainings in meditation practice. Not involve yourself, yeah? Allow things to pass by. Just see the mind for what it is without trying to control it in any way whatsoever. If you feel tired, you're tired. If somebody else makes a noise, all you hear is a noise, and then you continue on. You don't grasp onto anything. You allow the world, your mind, other people just to flow on, and you are just the passive observer. Sometimes people talk about bare awareness. Yeah, actually, Adam Brown has recently published a new book called Bare Awareness. But his bare awareness is that kind of bear over there. The kind of teddy bear awareness, that's Adam Brown's bare awareness. It's spelled slightly differently. Adam Brown likes to pun, as you probably know, having known him for a while. So that's the bare awareness. And that kind of bare awareness is actually also a good awareness, because it's kind of a kind, gentle awareness. Yeah, that's why we have teddy bears in here, to kind of make the atmosphere a bit more gentle. Bare awareness, the way it's usually used, is the idea of bare. It means that something is taken away. All you have left is awareness. But bare of what? What is the stuff that is taken away? What is it bare? What has actually been deducted? And the main thing that has been deducted is the willpower. Yeah, the idea of always trying to control the situation instead of allowing just the world to flow. Yeah, we always get involved. We always kind of grasp onto things. And that, I think, is the main idea of bare awareness. The idea of no willpower, allowing everything to flow naturally. And this is what we are also trying to do here by establishing mindfulness in this way. So this is how you establish mindfulness on this retreat. Also, you establish mindfulness by having the right attitude. Be kind to the people around you. Like I was saying yesterday, remember that this is what a wonderful thing it is to have such people around you. Yeah, like this. It's a wonderful thing to be in such company. And with that right attitude, the right way of looking at things, you also bolstering the mindfulness, the ability to be present right here, right now. But as with so many things on the Buddhist path, it is not just what you do now that matters. To enable you to be mindful, what you do in your daily life, your ordinary life, matters enormously. And you will find that in your meditation here, that your ordinary life will echo in your meditation. It will come back to you. Yeah, all these things that you are doing in ordinary life will actually come back and haunt you. And sometimes you will think about things and think, oh no, I shouldn't have done that. Why did I do that? Yeah, other times, the best way is like, yeah, I did that. Wow, that was really cool. I'm so glad I did that. That's the kind of positive idea you want to have in your meditation. And that shows you what Buddhist morality is all about. Buddhist morality is about coming here and being able to sit down and say, yes, I'm living well. I'm doing the right thing here. And then when you think, when that is the feeling that you have inside of you, that you're living well and doing the right thing, whoa, it is so easy to be mindful, because the present moment right here feels good. Yeah. If you feel, oh, I shouldn't have done that, that was kind of bad or whatever, of course the present moment becomes unpleasant. It's one of Ajahn Brahm's famous catchphrases, is the present moment, make the present moment a pleasant moment. Yeah. It's a very nice little catchphrase, and it actually is so true. When the present moment is pleasant, when you feel that sitting here and now feels good because you feel good about yourself, it is so easy to be mindful. And that's what morality is all about. We are moral because when you live well, when you are kind to the world around you, when you are stopped, when you don't do anything that hurts other people, it is natural, it is according to nature that you will feel good about yourself. Yes, okay, we have to do a bit of forgiveness sometimes. Nobody is absolutely perfect. But if you, the more you can kind of lean to the positive side of things, the more you can get away from the negative side of things. The sum, as long as the sum is positive, yeah, you will tend to feel good about yourself. So what we do, and this is one of the things you can maybe notice during this retreat, notice how your general life affects your meditation practice. It is all integrated. It is all one thing. We can never separate our ordinary life from the spiritual life. It is all part and parcel of the same thing. So this is what I was saying yesterday. We should subordinate our ordinary life to the spiritual life. When you subordinate, it means that how we live is far more important than what we actually do. You know, whether you are, whatever your occupation is, or whatever your social status is, or your family status is, that's not so important. What matters is how we fulfill these roles in society. You fulfill them in the right way, you come here and meditation becomes so much easier as a consequence. So this is why, how this path is so integrated. I'm going to talk more about morality later on, because the idea of morality is so fundamental and so profound on the Buddhist path. Morality goes so far. It's about how we think, how we perceive the world around us. All of these things are part and parcel of Buddhist morality. So I'm going to talk about that because it is so important and it matters so much. So you can see this idea of establishing mindfulness actually is this is so crucial and so important. And there are so many factors that come into this. And one of the factors I was mentioning yesterday as well, which is important, is this idea of having the right values in life. I was talking about the ujjukha ditti, straight view, seeing things in the right way. And the more you see things in the right way, the more priority you give to your mindfulness, the more priority you give to the spiritual path, because you understand that this actually matters. This is really important. This is actually where I will find lasting contentment, happiness, joy, peace, harmony with the world around me, all of these kind of things. The world may not be in harmony with me, but I can be in harmony with the world. And this is kind of what happens after a while. So this is about the right attitude, and that also enables the mindfulness and the meditation to happen. So these are some of the backgrounds, and this is fundamental, this is so important, and this is what makes meditation possible in the end. And then, when all of those things are established, and one of the things that you will find, those of you who have been doing this for a long time, is that every year these things get established a little bit more. Every year you come back and you see progress. Every year you see something is actually changed in your meditation practice. This is what I see in my life. I've been a Buddhist monk now for 22 years, I think it is. It doesn't seem like long, but when you think 22, actually, maybe it is going to be, it's a few years there. But it doesn't seem like long, but this is exactly what's happening. This gradual movement towards more positive states, towards more mindfulness, towards all of these wonderful things. And after a while, you start to get a very strong, solid confidence in these teachings, because you see that they actually really do deliver the results that they promise in the first place. And that's when you get really strong faith in this, yeah? So you have to kind of get over that initial bump and then kind of keep on doing it, doing it, doing it, and things start to take off as a consequence. And then it says here, ever mindful, you breathe in, ever mindful, you breathe out. So when all of those things are ready, then you start breathing. Actually, please breathe before that as well, otherwise you won't get there. But this is when you really observe the breath, yeah? So ever mindful, you breathe in, you breathe out. Ever here, the Pali word ever, I think, is not an ideal translation. The Pali word is eva. Probably not many of you who know Pali that well, but the word eva means, can mean many things. And one of the main meanings is just mindful. And here, I think that is actually the appropriate translation, just mindful. And the point here is that we are just mindful. We are not trying so hard. We're not putting in enormous amount of willpower. All you have to do is sit back and be mindful, be aware of the breath. Yeah? So you sit back and you are aware of the breath happening. So to be able to do that, of course, you have to have a lot of foundation into place. That's why the foundations are so important. And then eventually when you sit back, you just sit back. And this is why the meditation is so beautiful and why it is so nice, why it is so easy, yeah? Because all you have to do is sit back and be aware. No force, no willpower. So easy. Everything in life is kind of a striving towards something. Trying to pass your exams, trying to do this, trying to get an advancement in your career, trying to get this girlfriend or this boyfriend, yeah? Oh, I had to strive so hard, I had to kind of try all of these things all the time. And here, you're doing exact opposite, and you're getting far more happiness out of it without the striving. Isn't that wonderful? But of course, for that to work, you have to have the preparation in place. And then one day, you sit back, and you just watch the breath, and it's so easy, and it's so beautiful. Just mindful, you breathe in. Just mindful, you breathe out. There's nothing else that you have to do except being mindful and aware of the breath. And please notice that in your meditation practice. The less you do, the less there is going on, the more wonderful it is, the more beautiful it is, the more powerful it is. Yeah, take away all this extraneous stuff and just be aware. And then you start to understand that all this doing, all this willing business, actually, it is a problem. Actually, it is just an aspect of suffering, if you like. So ever mindful, not ideal, but just mindful. You breathe in, just mindful, you breathe out. I think is preferable in this particular case. And now we come to the actual breath. Yeah, now we come to the actual what we're supposed to do in this sutta. So I've taken about 41 minutes and 26 seconds, 27 seconds, 28 seconds. Right, so that's over two-thirds already of the talk is about all the preparations. Yeah, and that I think kind of balances out quite nicely what is important here. Because the rest is automatic. If there is no willpower involved, what does that mean? Well, it means it's automatic. Yeah, if there's no willpower, well, all that is left, and all you have to do is to be aware, means that the process is automatic. And this is one of those things. I always thought Ajahn Brahm was joking. Ajahn Brahm always said, yeah, just sit back, yeah, don't do anything, just sit there, and things will happen. And I thought, I felt out of my depth. I said, what am I just sitting? It felt very strange. How can you just sit there and everything happens? And of course, I didn't realize at the time that actually I had to do the preparation. I had to do all these other things. And then things would start to happen. But actually, you start to read the suttas of the Buddha and you find the Buddha is saying exactly the same thing. One of the suttas that I haven't included here, which I usually read out on every retreat that I do, is a sutta called the Chaitanya Sutta. And where the Buddha says quite specifically, he goes through, I mentioned this yesterday, the whole sequence that happens in meditation practice, all the various kinds of joy, until eventually you reach samadhi. And I mention that because the focus on happiness is so important there. But there was another focus in that sutta that I didn't mention yesterday, and that is where the Buddha says that this is not Chaitanya Karaniya. This is not to be done by intention. This is not to be done through volition, through the will. Yeah, the will has no place in the sequence of meditation practice. The will is something that gets in the way. Yeah. So this again, it fits in very beautifully with this idea that all you have to do is sit back and be aware. And as you do that, the whole process unfolds automatically. It feels so easy. It feels so natural. It feels so, it feels wonderful when you do this. And this is one of those remarkable aspects about meditation practice. You don't have to do very much. This is one of the things that you will see as we go through this. And this is why all the preparatory work is so important. That is what really matters, because the rest happens by itself. So what is it that happens by itself? And this is what happens by itself. Breathing in long, he understands, she understands, I breathe in long. Or breathing out long, he or she understands, I breathe out long. Breathing in short, he understands, I breathe in short. Or breathing out short, he understands, I breathe out short. Yeah, that's what happens. So you just sit there, the breath goes, and you know, okay, this is what the breath is like at this moment. You breathe long, you breathe short. So all this means is that you have an awareness of the breath. You know what is going on. That's really all it means. So it means that you don't lose the breath, you don't skip a breath, but you have enough awareness to know what is happening. That's really all it means. So what is this idea of long and short then? Why does it mention long and short? And I think the main reason is that as you become more peaceful, the breath often becomes shorter as you become more peaceful. Initially, as you relax, the breath becomes longer because you are just relaxing your stress or whatever. So the breath kind of take a deep breath, yeah, relax. That's kind of the beginning. But as you become even more peaceful, often the breath becomes shorter. This is really all this means. So you are aware, you follow the breath, you know what is happening. Long breath, short breath, you know what's going on there. And then, having started off with that basic thing, it says, he trains thus, I shall breathe in, experiencing the whole body of the breath. He trains thus, I shall breathe out, experiencing the whole body of the breath. I shall train thus, I shall breathe in, tranquilizing the bodily formation. He trains thus, I shall breathe out, tranquilizing the bodily formation. And what is happening here is that as you stay with the breath, you know the long breath, you know the short breath, as you do that, your mindfulness becomes more powerful. The mindfulness becomes more powerful because as you do this, as you are mindful, the world outside fades away. The hindrances in the mind fade away. If you don't feed the hindrances, a natural consequence of not feeding them is that they fade away. Yeah, so your desires, your attachments, your ill will, whatever it is, all that fades into the background because you're not feeding it anymore. And this is one of the reasons why we do breath meditation, because it naturally leads to a more pure mind. It's one of the consequences of just watching the breath. You become pure. Yeah, because you're not feeding those things that actually lead to impurity, and then purity happens automatically. Impurity can only exist as long as you feed it. Yeah, why do people become angry? Why do you get upset? The reason you get upset is because you're looking at another person in a certain way. That's why you get upset. So it's very simple not to get upset. All you have to do is look at that person in a different way. You don't get upset anymore. Yeah. I will show you how this works later on, because this is so important for our cultivation of morality, learning how to look at people and the world in the right way. You look at people in the right way, you never get upset anymore, because it needs fuel. Anger only happens when there's fuel for the anger. Take away the fuel, it doesn't happen anymore. So if you just keep on watching the breath, it has a natural purifying tendency. And because it purifies you, your ability to watch the breath increases. And that's why here it says you watch the whole breath. So you should, when you meditate, you should be able to experience this. Yeah, you experience that you have the long breath, your mindfulness is not very strong. And as it becomes stronger, you are aware of more and more aspects of that breath. You start to see the whole thing almost like a continuous thing. Yeah, The more powerful it is, the more powerful your mindfulness is, the more ability you have to see every aspect of that breath. This is all this means. Yeah, and it happens naturally as a matter of course as you go down. And then, as this happens, as the mindfulness improves, the next day that happens also automatically is that things start to become more tranquil. It says here, you tranquilize the bodily formation. And I have to admit that when, this is why people get a bit put off reading the suttas, because when somebody says you tranquilize the bodily formation, you wonder, what does this mean? Yeah, how can it? It's very hard to understand what tranquilizing the bodily formation means. And the only way you can really know that is by reading the discourse of the Buddha quite broadly. And then you know that this is just another way of saying tranquilizing the breath. Really, the better translation there would be tranquilizing the bodily activities. Yeah, the bodily activity, because the breath is an activity of the body. So the whole body becomes more peaceful. So the activities are calming down. Yeah, everything becoming more peaceful. Everything becoming very delightful when things become calm down. But remember, it says here, it trains. It may sound like that you are doing some kind of willpower or you are making this happen through your own agency here. But not, that is not actually what it means. Training here just means that you have to do this for a while. And as you do it for a while, it happens as a consequence. That is what it means. Yeah, so you see this beautiful process, watching the long breath, the short breath. Sometimes you don't even get to that point. Yeah, you can't even watch the long breath. All you do is just relax and you enjoy 2 days here. And that is already wonderful. If you can just enjoy staying here, that's already plenty good enough. You don't have to get further than that. You're already gaining benefits out of staying at Ranagrova. But if you do get to the mindfulness of breathing, even better. Yeah, then you are in kind of the elite company. Actually, that's really kind of putting it the wrong way, isn't it? But you are in kind of, you have already done a lot of homework already, if you can watch the breath. You have already done a lot of good things. And that enables you to do this. And then you will find, everybody finds that you come to a certain point where it doesn't really go any deep. It's like you plateau at a certain point and you can't really go any further. Everybody will have that feeling at some stage. Yeah, maybe you can watch the breath, but it doesn't really tranquilize. Maybe it tranquilizes, but it doesn't go beyond that to the bliss and all these kind of things. Yeah, so it's very, this is kind of a very common experience that you reach a certain point and then it kind of stops. And that's okay. Yeah. What you have to do then is to accept that at this point you are plateauing, if you like. It doesn't go deeper than that. Don't try to force it at that point because you get frustrated. Allow it to be like that. Just understand that the conditions are not in place for the meditation to become more profound. And if you accept that, and instead of trying to force the breath or force the peacefulness, instead you investigate and you ask yourself, why doesn't it go deeper? And the answer is often very simple. The answer is things like, the mind is not wholesome enough yet. You need a bit more wholesome qualities in there, a bit more positive perception and all these kind of things. Then there is a chance it will go deeper next time. So just remember that plateauing in this thing is very natural. Just don't force it to go any further. Try instead to investigate a little bit what is going on, and then you will find your way through this. So that is the first tetrad. These are called tetrads because there's 4 tetrads altogether. In other words, 4 steps of 4, and that is the first one, and that is equivalent in the Satipatthana Sutta to the contemplation of the body. The breath contemplation, the breath meditation is called contemplation of the body because the breath is also like a body. It is an aggregate of various breaths coming together here. So now we can move on. The next one then is equivalent to the Vedana Nupassana, the contemplation of feelings in the Satipatthana Sutta. And now things start to get very interesting. Remember that many of you may never get to these stages, and that's fine. It doesn't really matter. A lot of this is also to draw up the map and show you the map of where you're heading. Some of you will get to these things, and what a wonderful thing that is. But this is really just the map of where this breath meditation goes. So the second tetrad He trains thus, I shall breathe in experiencing rapture or joy. He trains thus, I shall breathe out experiencing rapture. He trains thus, I shall breathe in experiencing pleasure. This is sukha in Pali. He trains thus, I shall breathe out experiencing pleasure. He trains thus, I shall breathe in experiencing the mental activity. Here we have this word formation again, which to me doesn't mean much to me. I don't know what it means to you, but to me it's kind of not very meaningful. He trains thus, I shall breathe out experiencing the mental activity or formation. He trains thus, I shall breathe in, tranquilizing the mental formation. He trains thus, I shall breathe out, tranquilizing the mental formation or activity. So here you can see why this is called the contemplation of feelings. Because here we are dealing straight away with the feelings of the mind. Joy is obviously a feeling. It's a feeling, of course, in a very positive sense. And these are the type of feelings that we try to contemplate in Buddhism, are the positive feelings. Far more useful than to contemplate the pains and the problems is to kind of bypass all the problems. Yeah, isn't that a good idea? Bypass all the negative stuff, go straight for the good stuff. This is kind of the point of this. I reckon that it's a good kind of marketing ploy. You can get rid of the negative things, move on to the positive things. So this is why this is so great. Yeah, you don't have to contemplate the negative feelings, just move straight on to contemplate the joy here. I reckon that is really marvelous. But how do we then move from the tranquilizing of the body and the breath onto experiencing the rapture? How does that actually happen? And this is often, again, a place where people often plateau. It's hard. Maybe you can feel a certain degree of tranquility, but you don't get very much happiness arising in your meditation practice. So how does that happen? And very often it happens naturally. If you are ready, if you have done all these other aspects of the Noble Eightfold Path and all of those things, then when the tranquility reaches a certain level, you actually start to feel happy. Joy just arises by itself, because there is an inherent joy in being peaceful. And then when the mind is kind of leaning in the right direction, when the mind has the right values, if you like, it has the right outlook, then these things often happen automatically. If they don't happen, there are a few things we can do. And the Buddha gives some very beautiful examples in the suttas of what to do in this case. One of the most important things the Buddha teaches to give rise to joy in the meditation practice is actually to contemplate our conduct. This is called sila nusati in the Pali language. So if you have lived well for a long time, remember that. What a wonderful thing it is to keep the precepts all the time. What an amazing thing that is in the world, to keep the five precepts all the time. When you keep the five precepts all the time in your ordinary life, it means that you are giving so much to the people around you. Freedom from fear, freedom from that you're going to take advantage of them. You're not going to steal anything from them. You're not going to kind of commit adultery with a partner or anything like that. You're not going to lie to them. What a wonderful thing it is to know that somebody will not almost always tell you the truth. Okay, then maybe they will slip up occasionally, but generally speaking, they will tell you the truth and they will be trustworthy. So you are, by keeping the five precepts, after a while we get so used to keeping the five precepts, we forget how wonderful that is, and what a gift it is to the world when we keep these simple things. So remember that. Remember the conduct that you do, the help that you have given, whether it is at the Buddhist Society. Many of you have been members there for a long time and done lots of good work there. Remember anything else that you have done in your life to live well. Remember your generosity. This is another of the Buddha's specific advice to give rise to joy, that you have been generous, you have been kind, you have been supportive in so many different ways. Remember that. When you do that, you're kind of focusing on those aspects that support your meditation practice. And as for all the mistakes you have done, we all done mistakes, right? Forgive that. remember that it's impossible to live a human life without making mistakes. Of course we're going to make mistakes. Don't beat yourself up because you've done a few things, made a few errors of judgment in your life. Everybody does that. It is because of your conditioning. It is not something that you can control. The reason why you beat yourself up over these things is because you think you should have done better. No, you shouldn't have done better. It's impossible to do better because you are conditioned to be who you are. You almost had to do those things. Yeah. And once you get into this idea of conditioning, into this idea that we are what we are the sum of those things that happened in the past, it is actually quite easy to forgive yourself, at least, of those small little things that we do in life. This doesn't mean that you should kind of go out and do lots of bad stuff, right? Oh yeah, I'll just forgive myself later on. It doesn't work like that. If you think like that, you won't be able to forgive yourself because you are feeling that, now I can kind of, get my way with the Buddhist path and kind of I know all the tricks and it won't be a problem. But if you do that, then you're bringing your ego into the situation. And because you're bringing your ego into the action, you won't be able to forgive yourself because, again, it will feel like you were doing it. So this is not a license to do whatever you want, right? Please don't get me wrong. Otherwise, I will get fired by Ajahn Brahm. Nobody's keeping the precepts anymore. They say, all you have to do is forgive yourself. So please don't get me fired, because that would be bad karma also for you if you did that, right? So this is the way to do it. Live to the best of your ability. If you make mistakes, of course you make mistakes. Forgive that. And then rejoice in the fact that you are living well. Rejoice in the fact that you are voluntarily coming here, yeah, to be part of this retreat. What a wonderful thing that is. If you didn't have a good heart, if you weren't well-intentioned, if you weren't a good person, you would never be here. What's the point of being here if you don't have some kind of good intentions? Unless maybe somebody dragged you here. Were any one of you dragged here by your wife or husband or your parent or whatever it is? Probably you all came voluntarily, right? So, wow, what a wonderful thing that is. I'm a monk voluntarily. Wow, what a wonderful thing that is, yeah? So all of this is this kind of thing that we use in our meditation. And you can use this at this particular point in your practice. Everything is going well. You kind of stop for a few seconds and say, wait a minute, what an amazing thing it is to be here. I am part of this. How wonderful this is. The world, okay, the world. Many strange things happening in the world, but many good things happening in the world. Wow. And then you kind of get an uplift, sense of joy inside of you that things are going well. And then you start to feel good inside of you. And that gives you a little bit of boost in your meditation practice. And then that joy, that piti may actually start to appear. Or it may not, yeah? This is the problem. Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. It's unreliable. It's unreliable because the mind, always moving, always changing, is uncertain what will happen next. So then the joy happens. And this is where meditation starts to become really nice and really beautiful and really wonderful. And then, as you keep on practicing, this is where you start to see a different side to the whole world. You start to understand where real happiness is to be found. Suddenly everything gets turned upside down. You thought before that happiness in the world was in all these other external things. But for the first time you start to realize, actually, in meditation there is something extraordinary, powerful and beautiful to be had. And it is found just by sitting peacefully down and doing nothing except watching your breath. And there you find more meaning, more purpose, more significance, more happiness, more contentment, more joy, more metta, more everything than you find in anything that you do in the rest of your life. And this really starts to change your value system. Now your value system starts to get turned upside down. This is the beginning of that. Yeah? And the deeper you go, the more your values will be changed because you start to see the world in an entirely new way. And this is part of what is so powerful and beautiful about this path. And it's not scary at all. In fact, it is just feels liberating. That's how it feels. It feels like you are freeing yourself of burdens and problems and all of these kind of things. Anyway, I've already been talking for just a little bit over an hour. So I shall stop there and we shall continue this afternoon with the rest of the sutta. There's even more beautiful and powerful stuff coming later on. But for now, we're going to have luncheon, so please enjoy your lunch as well. And then when you enjoy your lunch, you can enjoy your meditation. So lunch just the right amount, so just the right quantity, and then you kind of enjoy your meditation again afterwards as well. So please keep on having a good time, and we'll see you back at 3 o'clock.